Welcome to the Art Scene, brought to you each week by UALR Public Radio. I'm Ann Nicholson. Guest conductor will be putting the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra through its paces on November the 10th and 11th in the second Masterwork Concerts of the 2018-19 season. And she is my guest today. Her name is Sarah Ioannidis, and she and I had quite a go round the world before settling down for a conversation. Now, you've just come down from Sweden, up in the north, at the top of the tower. It has produced some amazing music. What did you perform for them in your conducting?
Well, we had had 3 weeks there, and great diversity of music, everything from Beethoven's Eroica to actually two women composers, Lily Boulanger's De Matin du Printemps, The Morning of Spring. There was another piece I conducted, which is just a really, really charming, wonderful work, which she wrote when she was extremely young, shortly before she died, very tragically died at a very young age. And her sister, the elder, never quite got over it, but she became one of the most important teachers of 20th century music, Nadia Boulanger. So that was one other work we did. I'm also been recording some music by a very talented Swedish composer called Marie Samuelsson. And with Malmö Symphony, we recorded the final part of the trilogy. It's a love trilogy that is three different movements involving a clarinet solo for one and soprano solo for another work with orchestra, and also a purely orchestral work which actually features musicians speaking within the text, is actually within the orchestra. And it's really a display of three different types of love, both the passionate romantic love, the love of your children, and also the love of humanity, of people, and its sharing of solidarity and the effect of that. So it's been a wonderful week, and of course some Mozart and some Leopold Mozart was in there too. And on the program was also a Louise Farenc, another great romantic composer, contemporary of Beethoven, in fact, but very similar in style to Schumann.
By this time, I had decided to let Sarah carry the ball of conversation, a kaleidoscope of hither and thither, and when I was able, I put in a question or comment. So, your background is fascinating. Born in Australia, and I gather that your father, composer and conductor, was working over there?
Yes, that's right. He was actually working in the research lab as a chemist at the time. That was before he changed to his musical career, which was always his passion.
And did he stay in the same place for a while?
Well, he left to go to London when I was very young and study at the Guildhall School of Music Conducting. And we then moved back to England, and he moved to Germany, where he started his career as a conductor. And so we did not live in the same country the majority of my life. And now he lives in Cyprus. He's partly retired and a composer and conductor still, and teaches a little. And I'm the one who's rotating around him now.
Did you go to the Guildhall as well?
I did, yes. I did study. And my grandfather also.
Ah, yep. Your grandfather might remember the name of my voice teacher when he was at the Guildhall. Joseph Hislop was a tenor who was very well known and trained. He was a Scot, and he lived in London when I met him and when I took voice control with him, because I had hopes of being a singer one day. But you've been, other than in just Australia and England, it intrigued me to know the background your parents had. Your mother was a Scot originally.
Yep.
So where was she when he and she got married?
They met at St. Andrews, where they were both studying. My father was doing postdoctoral work there. Actually, I think he got his doctorate there in in biochemistry.
Your mother?
Met in St. Andrews.
St. Andrews.
Where they both went to. We're studying.
Yes. So a true born in the Scot.
Yep.
Do you go back there much?
Well, I have not been to where my mother grew up, unfortunately. So, no, I'm more native to going to Cyprus, where my father lives, and mm-hmm. my mother now is in England. And, of course, I was born in Australia, so...
And you were obviously in Australia long enough to be considered an Australian when you were a baby.
Yeah, for a few years.
So... there you are with all this background, and you grew up mostly in England. Where were you living in England itself for schooling before you went to university?
My first place in England was actually not in England, it was in Wales. So we lived in Flint, in Clwyd, with my grandmother for a year of schooling there, and then in Ludlow, in Shropshire, for 5 years. And then we moved, my mother remarried, and we moved to Dorking in Surrey. And that became my home for the next 6 years. And then I went away to boarding school, not far from Dorking, at Cranley for sixth form. Then from there to Oxford for undergraduate, and then to London.
And the college that you were in London, was that in Oxford? Is that Somerville?
Yes, that's right.
And where... in all this coming and going and boarding schools and things of this nature, did the music start?
Well, I think the music was definitely in my genes, so it really began when I was very little. I mean, back in Australia, I was favouring listening to recordings and, you know, experimenting with the children's instruments that you have when you're little, telephones and things. And then, of course, I studied many instruments as I was getting older. And that developed quite significantly in my teenage years until I was about 17 is really when I first started to conduct. I was in the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain and watching some incredible, and training under some incredible conductors. And there I really started to get an interest.
In one snippet in your biography was the mention of the youth orchestra. And I remember going up from London to Scotland in the train which was carrying one of the countries that was all part of the world of the youth orchestra. And it fascinated me talking to so many different countries all in one train. And it seemed to me that this was a wonderful way to start that sort of a worldwide interest by virtue of the fact that you were teaching and you were learning something that really appealed to you and then became part of you when you became a member of as big and as interesting and as varied as a youth orchestra.
It's like music is a global language and certainly a wonderful means of communication between many different backgrounds and citizens.
The other things that you had going for you as you grew were the instruments that you found. And you had three: piano, horn, and
violin.
Which one? Did they all come at once, or did you just fall into listening to the different instruments to decide which one appealed to you the most?
There were actually more instruments than those three primary ones, because I seem to be fascinated with how the different instruments worked and how they came part of the orchestra. Of course, I started with a recorder because that's what you learn, you know, in kindergarten at school. But at the first opportunity, I took piano lessons. And at the first opportunity to learn a string instrument, I took violin lessons. And, you know, then, of course, they then say who would like to sign up for the brass program, and my hand went up. At every opportunity, somebody says, who'd like to play this? So my mother was overwhelmed, I think, with my interest in learning as many instruments as possible. So I actually started on the tenor horn, because that's what the brass folks were teaching there. And when I moved from Shropshire to Surrey, they didn't have any county instruments available to lend me because, you know, with many instruments, one can only afford so many, and you take a loaner when you can. But they said, we have a French horn available. So I said, well, I didn't really want to learn the French horn. They said, but you can then play in the orchestra. And I said, well, I play the violin in the orchestra. I wanted to play a band instrument so that I could also play in bands. But anyway, I was convinced. And of course, you know, the transposition side of things became very, very interesting later on because the French horn has to transpose horns in E-flat, horns in F, horns in B-flat. And so it became a wonderful education to play the French horn for a conductor. It reminds me often when I went away to Gatton Park and I had the horn with me and I came back with sort of blisters on my fingers because the instrument's pretty heavy for a young kid. And, you know, swollen lips from, you have to play pretty hard pressure on the mouthpiece to be able to get all the pitches. And then, you know, really, you're not supposed to rest it on your leg. You're supposed to hold it the whole time. But it's, as I said, it's heavy for a child. So it's quite hard work and you have to persevere. And it becomes more and more satisfying. But again, it's probably the most unpredictable of the instruments.
Do you speak several languages?
My mother is a linguist, so certainly having family living in different countries makes one immediately interested in the language that they speak. And of course, my father spoke a number of languages, and when he lived in Germany, I wanted to learn German so I could be part of the culture that and world that he lived in. And so that became my second language, really. And I tried to pick up parts of French. Of course, my mother was a French teacher. We learnt French at school. I tried to learn a bit of Greek because, of course, when I was in Cyprus, I wanted to understand what they were saying. And likewise with the other languages that one needs in music, Italian, Spanish, even Russian. Whenever I had the opportunity, I would just try to study it. And it's really beneficial as a musician to...
And with a number of families, languages... Each one that you find another grip on makes it another part of you and gives you a tremendous edge in terms of moving around when the world is such a small place.
That's right. Yeah, we're very lucky that so many countries speak English, of course, but it makes us slightly less eager to learn the other languages.
Yeah.
So it can be hard to educate your children in languages when you're so far away from, you know, Europe and a multitude of languages. But still, we try as well.
So do you have children?
Yes, I do. I have three children.
I remember seeing that. One is just fairly new. And languages will be part of their background as well, because you'll be very careful to make sure that they know what they're going to get into.
Certainly, we try. We try.
Yes.
I have twins who are 8 and a 10-year-old daughter, as well as my girl and boy twins. So that's a great joy.
Indeed. And fun with languages. You'll have to make up some new languages. You left school, went to Oxford, and... At Somerville, you got into more involved languages. What did you do there for reading?
Well, really, I was working to complete a highly academic degree in music, so I was not having time, really, apart from maybe when I was abroad, to study languages. I was really focused in developing my early studies as a conductor, and I had several orchestras and a choir. And I was also responsible for a lot of the planning for those. So it was really an early education in music management as well as conducting. And I was, of course, playing the violin and French horn and trying to satisfy my academic degree there in music. So I was pretty busy on the musical side of things.
When did you pick up the baton and decide to be a conductor?
Oh, that was when I was about, before going to Oxford, I was about 17. Interest began to develop when I was at the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain when I was about 16, and I really started to have some lessons and figure out what one needs to know and learn to become a conductor, other than picking up the baton, of course, which is only one very small part of becoming a conductor.
A lot of people don't use it anyway. So your education in that particular field is being appealed to from America, or did you yourself put forward that you went to America?
No, I wished to go there because I heard about a phenomenal teacher. He sadly passed away not so long ago, but he's a German teacher called Otto Werner Müller, and he was teaching at the Juilliard School of Music and the Curtis Institute of Music. And so when I heard that he was probably one of the greatest conducting teachers living, it was my goal to try to study with him. So I applied, and I also applied for funding, and was very fortunate to receive scholarships. Both Curtis and Juilliard launched really my early career in the USA.
And how long were you there?
2 years at Curtis and 2 years at Juilliard.
And then you went to Cincinnati?
I first of all came back to England and applied for jobs from the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Because I was a recipient of a Fulbright scholarship, and there's a home rule, and you know, I was able to come back to England and look for opportunities, but still I was attracted and made many contacts in the USA, and so I decided that would be a good place to continue. So it was about a year or so later, and that's when I was asked to become the assistant conductor of Cincinnati Symphony.
We lived in Kentucky for a short while, and I was taking a degree, a PhD in music, and I worked in Cincinnati and added to my degrees, and then we moved to Ohio. We moved around a bit too.
Yeah.
So you went into further interesting things. You met several composers. And was this a deliberate thing so that you could understand better the works that you were dictating?
Well, it's always gone hand in hand with my studies as a conductor, is to also study the music of living composers, those colleagues around me. I mean, Guildhall School of Music was marvelous about connecting conductors and composers, having them work together, having them understand what works, what doesn't work. And my father is a composer. I've even composed a little myself. So, you know, I really feel that it's critical to support living composers and foster them. I mean, you're in a wonderful position as a conductor to be able to promote and share mm-hmm. music of living composers, as well as, of course, the immense history of not living composers, dead composers, of which there are many more. Mm-hmm. But I think the two must coexist so that we can continue to foster great living talent and continue the development of classical music into the future. So it's always been part of my life to cherish composers and seek great composers, and now in particular I'm seeking wonderful women composers, not only living ones but past composers like Fanny Mendelssohn, Clara Schumann, Louise Ferenc, even who were the women composers behind Bach or behind Mozart, or, you know, Mozart's sister, and just this incredible history of women composers who we don't know about because they were not really able to perform.
Yes, the Mendelssohns and all their great, great similarities with others. In this book of your background, Stephen Paulus, you mentioned. And I met him in the Ozarks because there's a lovely opera festival in the Ozarks here in Arkansas. And he was very friendly and very interested in taking texts from novels, The Woodlanders and others, writing of the reading, as it were. Mm-hmm. And then he died, which was very sad. You were in El Paso for a while. And I wondered if you did much with Zul Bailey.
Yes, he's a marvelous cellist and great director of the Chamber Music Festival in El Paso and also in other places. I've performed with him a number of times.
Sorry. I met him when he was 18, when he was just a student finishing his high school. And I just fell in love with him. And he and I have been communicating a bit over the years because he is so talented and so delightful and so full of zest. And these last ones he did you hear him or did you hear the works about Hemingway?
No, tell me.
This was composed by Doherty in one of the eastern states. And Zuhl was the one who was the perpetrator of his music. And they won all kinds of awards in the last few years because of this. And I thought, well, if you were that close with that interest of new works and with a person like Zuhl Bailey, you would be enthralled at the zest with which these composers and performers and real just people.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this upcoming program, we also have a really incredible composer, Joan Tower, one of the really important American women composers. And I'm really looking forward to conducting Made in America by her.
And is this a new one?
It's not a new work. It's actually one of the big ones that kind of launched a little bit of her career. And it was an early piece of hers.
Ah, because she has been here before. And I hadn't heard her name locally for quite a while, so I haven't really picked up on what she has been working on. Has she been producing operas, or what kind of musical size and shape of style comes from her?
Well, many great orchestral pieces she's worked on and been performed by great orchestras, but certainly there's many solo pieces, a lot of chamber music works, large ensemble pieces, but 14 substantial orchestral pieces and goodness, many soloist and orchestra works as well. So, A Purple Rhapsody for viola, for example, and oboe and string orchestra. She's a great, passionate Beethoven lover, so you can hear a lot of developmental works that she even wrote, I think, a homage to Beethoven. But, she's been around a while now, and I think it's, it's wonderful to celebrate her in her sort of 80th birthday year, which is what we're doing now with this Made to America, which was one of the earlier works that was written. It was, I think, recorded in 2008. So it's been around a while, and it really talks about her love of, United States and living in a free world, and integrates the song of America the Beautiful into the music. For somebody who kind of grew up in South America and was the daughter of a mining engineer, she's got a very interesting perspective and appreciation for, the freedom to become an artist in the United States.
So when you were asked to come down here to direct the three pieces that you will be working with, what was your initial reaction? Because one of them is very popular and very well known, the Moldau, Mavlast.
Mm-hmm.
And then Elgar, which one is the one that everybody tries to remember?
The Enigma variation.
Yes.
Yes.
And I wondered if you'd had your little idea of who that one might have been that everybody tries to guess.
Well, there is sort of two mysteries in the Enigma. I mean, one is the mystery of who each of the pieces, the variations, who do they represent? And, of course, we know mostly who those are. But then the other enigma, what is that? And it's actually believed that it involves a hidden melody. It's not actually a person. It's a melody that is within the music that only he knew. And he did not want it to be discovered. He did not want it to be shared. That's interesting to try to find it, but I don't know if anybody really can say that they know it. But most of the music, of course, it's really specific to a different personality, and that's what he tried to sketch. And so, the overall idea of this program is really about people and landscapes, and there's a common thread, and that is the love of the home country. If you look at the Smetana, it is very much a love for his homeland. He actually was forced to leave it for a while, and he lived in Sweden. And when he came back, he really made it his home again in Prague and tried to tell the stories of both the ancient, you know, Bohemian stories that, that fascinated him, as well as so not only the people but also the landscape, the river that runs through the Vltava, how it swirls through the St. John Rapids, and how it moves towards Prague, and then and passes the Vyšný Hrad, which is just an incredible view. I don't know if, I'm sure some of your listeners have been out there to Prague, but what a beautiful homeland, and you can totally understand why he loved it. And, you know, with each of those pieces, there's a very much a kind of sense of pride in the language, the musical language from which each of those composers come. Elgar is a really landmark piece, the Enigma, but Elgar himself wrote in a very English style. I mean, you think of all those pomp and circumstance dances, and you know, Joan Tower, in her way, she celebrates America with the wonderful, beautiful America the Beautiful song. That, so there's a kind of a string of nationalistic thinking through these pieces, and it's really them each telling their story about landscapes and about the people that are important to them or to their history, for example.
Mm-hmm. I've often wished that was this national anthem. To me, I get the tingle when people sing America the Beautiful.
Yes, it is wonderful. Yes.
And thank you so much. I just hope that you will enjoy it here. It's a bit cold and rainy at the moment, but it does change.
I'm very much looking forward to being in Little Rock. Very much. I've heard a lot about it over the years, and I think this is just going to be a marvelous week, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's coming up quite fast on us, and I hope to meet you in person.
Yes.
And hope to see you at the concert.
Indeed. Travel safely and stay well, and we will see you soon. Was Sarah Ioannidis, who will be on the podium in Robinson Center November 10th and 11th for the second Masterworks Concerts of the 2018-19 season. The program opens with Joan Tower's Made in America, then The Moldau by Smetana, and closes with The Enigma Variations by Edward Elgar. To the Sunday matinee, students kindergarten through 12 are admitted free when accompanied by a ticket-holding adult. And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.